thanks for the kind invitation. In the next panel, we discuss about the evolution of emerging power interactions. And we have the presence of Tao Chen from Tsinghua University, China, Erika Downs, Brookings Institution, Sergio Chichava from ES, Rhys Jenkins, University of East Anglia, and Paul Esteves, PUC Rio, BRICS Policy Center. Well, according to the program, Tao Cheng will be the first speaker. And I have, of course, some proposal. I know that investment is your favorite issue, but probably everybody of knows we like to know about the evolution of economic reforms in China. According to Wen Jiabao, economic growth model in China was unsustainable, uncoordinated, and unbalanced. So the reforms were urgent. These economic and political reforms are very complex because they challenge relevant areas of political power in China. State banks, state-owned enterprises, local governments, in other words, high-level officials in the party hierarchy. So, probably reforms will be necessarily gradual and incremental. And the first question is, in the short term, is there a clear signal of progress in these reforms? And linking with that, corruption is another issue in the Chinese debate. After the last third plenum, the anti-corruption campaigns have great diffusion in Chinese media. But the question is if these clear efforts are oriented to fight against the structural roots of the corruption or only cosmetic modification. In words of Xi Jinping, is this campaign affecting also the tigers or only affect mosquitoes? Some of the questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. And I would also like to thank President Garcia for inviting me here. I have to disappoint you a little bit because I was given the topic like current trend of trade and investment among Asia, Africa, and Latin America. I know you might not want to know more about China. I guarantee to come back to you when you ask a question, okay? I need to do my job, otherwise they won't invite me anymore.
Next time again.
Yeah. I'm going to do things relatively short because this morning we had a wonderful discussion and some of the topics have been covered by them. So I just depend on the point, okay? Regarding this topic, the current trend of the trade and investment among Asia, Africa, and Latin America, I want to make 3 points. One, the growth trend is very true in absolute term. Second, the growth rate is relatively true. Third, how we make the trend sustainable. So actually for the first one, this morning many academics have already mentioned that the trade among these three regions really grow fast, and especially between the Asia with the Africa and Asia with the Latin America. The trade between the Latin America and Africa is relatively less, okay? And on the other side, and if we talk about the investment, the volume of the investment cannot really match the trade volume among these three regions. But we still have a tremendous growth. Take China as an example. The Chinese offshore FDI, outward FDI, I mean Chinese company going abroad, basically started to accelerate it from 2004. And then most of the Chinese investment has been in the developing country, other than in the developed country. So from this fact, basically we have already realized the South Country, we become more market to each other, and we become more a capital source for each other. Actually, from Chinese experience, I can see good reason for this trend. It's not temporary. I can identify like four, not drivers, area, okay? One, you can see from the demand area and the national income basically improve in many South countries. And also, the other thing is very important. The demand characteristic in the South country is relatively similar. So that's make more room for the product from South country. So that's one of the demand sides. From the supply side, and many South countries have already developed the human capital, technology, as well as infrastructure to some extent. So we can make more and better product for each other. This is the second one. The third one I thought is very much important is that we actually, through all these years' development, we have accumulated the knowledge of how to make our own development. You know, beforehand, at the very beginning of China, when we do the reform, we look up the Soviet Union, we look up the Korea and Japan, we look up U.S. all the time, and we will listen to everybody, okay? We test this and test that. And right now, we sort of have more confidence. I'm not saying we can get everything right, but we have more confidence to identify which the advice could be more appropriate for us, which means we have the capability to do our own direction, to make our own decision, to figure out what is the right way to go. I think that's a very much important thing. The fourth thing is that our South Country, actually we found each other. We feel we can cooperate more so that we can achieve more together. You can see the agreement among South Country actually increased tremendously. So put everything together, I feel that the fact right now we have already seen is not a temporary one, and we do have the good reason behind that. That's the one point. The second thing is that the trend is relative one from at least two perspectives. One is that we are still living in a world dominated by the developed country, which is true. Even though we grow faster than them, but they are still take the biggest pie. The second thing is that actually I believe almost every developing country, we start our development by the relationship with the developed world. They help us a lot. And this link is very strong, and we have already strengthened this link through the last decades. So I think that's also, if you look at the trade and investment, and you can find the number that those part is actually stronger, not weaker. They're just relatively slower than the things happen among us. So that is the what I said, the growth trade is relatively true, okay? And then based on what I said just now, and I feel if we want to make the things this trend sustainable, there's only two way out. One is that we really need to cooperate more in the future. There are several several areas that really need to cooperate more. One, we do not really understand each other very much. And then we could be misunderstood for each other. For example, when Chinese company investing in Africa, and then and they basically know Chinese company, they accumulated so many years experience in terms of doing infrastructure. You know, we have improved a lot of infrastructure inside China. And they can do things better and in a shorter time and relatively cheaper, which is really good. But when a Chinese company is getting into Africa and they have one more requirement, they want Chinese company to immediately hire their local people. I really understand their demand, but I have to explain to them, you know, the infrastructure is so important to the country. And why China can do it like what you described? Because China accumulated experience within their own team, okay? So why not just let them do the job first And then, of course, they're going to train your people so that you can remain your road and fix it. You know, the road is yours, okay? And after so many years, actually so many years' experience, now there's so, at least at the conference I attend, there's not so much this type of question coming in. So, okay, to put the long story short. So we find the room of improvement by improving mutual understanding among the South Country. Secondly, we can share our experience of making development. That's something that only can share among us. And the third thing is that we need to... I forgot. Anyway, and the other clear law is that we need to strengthen our tie with the developed world. I think that's a very, very important thing to do. And we'll try all our best not to be misunderstood by, you know, the growing South is against the declining of the North. This is really not the truth. We'll try all our best to avoid those type of misunderstanding. I think we need everybody to get together so that we can create the foundation for the sustainability of the continued growth, the continued rise of the South. And of course, it's also the basic for the continued rise of the whole world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chow Tao. And the answer, we'll wait for the next meeting. Enrique, next meeting. Now, we have the participation of Erica Downs. We talk about China and Venezuela, trade, investment, and development diplomacy. Some guidelines with probably the same luck with the question posed to Tao Tao. One point. The economic relationship between China and Venezuela is increasingly important. However, there is little transparency in official data on bilateral trade, investment, and characteristic of Chinese loans. Right now, Venezuela is facing strong inflationary pressures and a maxi devaluation risk. My point is there awareness of this scenario in Chinese investors?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. And I'd also like to thank COF and LSE for the opportunity to participate in this event. I'm going to talk about China Development Bank and its growing global role with a special reference to Venezuela, which is one of the bank's most important foreign customers. China Development Bank, or CDB, has emerged as an increasingly important actor on the world stage since the global financial crisis. Just to give you a few data points to put that in perspective, China Development Bank's outstanding foreign currency loans, which are a rough proxy for its international lending, grew from $65 billion in 2008 to almost $250 billion last year. And for comparison, the World Bank's outstanding loans were $136 billion for fiscal year 2012 and $144 billion for fiscal year 2013. So in a very short period of time, China Development Bank has substantially ramped up its international lending. And the increase in the bank's lending is very much rooted in the global financial crisis when the commodity price collapse and the credit crunch provided the bank with an opportunity to substantially expand its international portfolio, primarily through extending energy-backed loans to borrowers in emerging economies, including Brazil, Ecuador, Ghana, Russia, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. Venezuela is the largest recipient of oil-backed loans from China Development Bank, and the bank's engagement with Venezuela provides a window into its growing global activities. So what I'd like to do in the remainder of my time is to quickly address three questions that shed some light not only on the bank's relationship with Venezuela, but also other emerging economies. And those three questions are, one, who is China Development Bank, or CDB? Two, what is CDB doing in Venezuela and why? And three, what comes next for Venezuela and the rest of the world? So to begin, who is China Development Bank? Well, CDB is a wholly state-owned bank which aims to profitably advance China's national interests. It was one of three so-called policy banks created in 1994 to handle state-directed lending. And the bank's primary mission is to support the Chinese government's medium and long-term development goals as the government understands those goals at any given time. Domestically, the bank has bankrolled the development of strategic industries and much of the infrastructure that has underpinned China's economic boom. And internationally, CDB's priorities include helping Chinese companies enter foreign markets, securing access to energy and raw materials, and broadly advancing foreign policy goals. And it's important to note that while the bank is not solely motivated by profit maximization, it does not want to support projects that will incur losses for the bank. So what is CDB doing in Venezuela and why? The bank has extended more than $45 billion in mostly oil-backed loans to borrowers in Venezuela. The biggest borrower in Venezuela is BANDES, or the Venezuelan Bank for Economic and Social Development, and they have received $36 billion from China Development Bank, and all of these loans are supported by oil supply contracts. And the bank has also lent about $8.5 billion to PDVSA, the Venezuelan National Oil Company, and to CVG, the Venezuelan National Mining Company. And most of that money has gone to PDVSA. And it looks like some of these loans are some of these loans have been commodity-backed. Others may not be. I haven't been able to, you know, confirm that each of these loans is indeed supported by a commodity supply contract. Now, the $36 billion in oil-backed loans that CDB has extended to BANDES account for more than one-third of the approximately $100 billion worth of energy-backed loans that CDB has extended to borrowers around the world since 2005. Now, why is China Development Bank doing this? There are a couple of reasons, and my bottom line here is that it's not simply about oil. Oil is part of the story, but there are other national and corporate interests at play. Obviously, one of them is oil. The contracts are supported by oil supply contracts. China's a big importer of oil, so there is a perception in China that these loans and the oil supply contracts that support them are good for China's oil security. But CDB is also making these loans to help generate business for Chinese firms and to find new markets for China's exports. And some of the loans, for example, there was a loan back in 2010 that was a $20.6 billion loan, and half of that was issued in Chinese currency, which basically tied Venezuela into buying and hiring from China. And as a result of that, you see a lot of Chinese goods, you see trucks, you see rigs, vehicles going into Venezuela. And we also see Chinese companies undertaking projects in Venezuela. To go over what these loans are accomplishing for China, it's not just oil, it's business for Chinese firms, and it's also new export markets. And this was very important to China in the immediate wake of the global financial crisis, when there was a sense we may not be able to count on the developed economies to buy as much stuff from us as they did in the past, so we need to find new markets, and extending loans that require other countries to buy stuff from us is one way to do that. And finally, it's important to note that CDB itself has an interest here, in that they look at their international business. They look at these commodity-backed loans as providing a new engine of growth for the bank. You know, despite all the money it's lent abroad, this only constitutes about a quarter of its lending. So 75% of its lending is domestic. A lot of it has gone for infrastructure. And there's a recognition that even though China still has a lot of infrastructure left to build, there's still a lot of urbanization that has to occur in China. There's a recognition that as this urbanization and infrastructure construction process matures, that the bank is going to increasingly have to look for more opportunities overseas. Now, when China Development Bank first started lending to Venezuela, I got a lot of questions in Washington, D.C. Why is China Development Bank doing this? They must be crazy. Venezuela seems like a pretty risky borrower. And these concerns became more acute and were voiced much more often after the death of President Chavez last year. I have noticed that the bank has appeared over the last year to be more reluctant to extend more lines of credit to BANDES. I think that initially, this probably had to do with the death of Chavez and uncertainty about the political transition in Venezuela. However, I don't think that's the case today, in part because President Maduro appears to value his relationship with Venezuela and CDB as much as Chavez did. And so my sense is that the reluctance of CDB to extend more lines of credit to bandits has more to do with Chinese concerns about transparency and also about Venezuela's ability to service new loans in the future. We already heard a bit about the transparency issue, that there have been a lot of media reports about how the bank is concerned not just about how the loans are being used, do they know where all the money's going, but over the summer there were some reports about mismanagement of the funds from China in Venezuela. And there's also concerns about, does Venezuela have enough oil available for export to service new loans? This may sound crazy because Venezuela is sitting on a lot of hydrocarbon reserves, but from the Chinese perspective, the issue is those reserves are still in the ground. They're not barrels ready for export. Venezuelan production has declined since 2006, and a particular concern to the Chinese are that production increases at Chinese-invested projects in Venezuela have been slower than expected, even though the growth in the development of these projects is not legally linked to any of the loans. My understanding is there's an expectation in China that we have companies involved there. Hopefully they can grow Venezuelan production, and that will enhance the country's ability to service our loans. And the progress that has been made has fallen short of what people were hoping for. And so I think this also contributes to the reluctance to lend more. It's important to note that China Development Bank did lend $4 billion to PDVSA, the Venezuelan national oil company, last year. But I view this as an entirely different type of project than lending to bandits. And I think for China Development Bank, this is a much lower risk project, for two reasons. One is that it involves a Chinese company, and the bank likes to lend to projects that involve Chinese companies as a risk management tool. And here, there's a perception that if a Chinese company is involved and if the output of that product is going to be sold to China, in this case it's oil, then that lowers the risk. And there are also reports that the loan to PDVSA to support this joint venture oil project, that the Chinese will have more control over how that is used, that it's actually going to be the joint venture itself that manages the loan as opposed to just PDVSA or someone in Caracas. And I've also heard that the loan is going to be dispersed incrementally depending on progress. So the $4 billion check isn't going to be written at once, that instead it's going to be dispersed in tranches. And so I guess finally, by way of conclusion, what comes next for Venezuela and the rest of the world in terms of CDB lending? For Venezuela, I think that CDB is likely going to be will remain reluctant to extend more lines of credit to bandits if there continues to be little progress in ramping up the country's oil production. That being said, I would not be surprised if the bank made more loans to PDVSA specifically for the purpose of ramping up that production, especially if there's a Chinese company involved. And it's important to note that this isn't something that's unique to China and Chinese companies, that there are other oil companies like the U.S. firm Chevron, the Russian company Rosneft, that are lending money to PDVSA to support joint venture oil production projects in hopes of increasing Venezuela's oil output. Globally, I think the bank will probably continue to provide commodity-backed loans to exporting countries who need infrastructure built and that have markets for Chinese goods because, as I mentioned earlier, such loans do advance a variety of interests for a variety of actors in China. That being said, although oil-backed loans grow CDB's balance sheet, at this point they're not doing a lot to enhance the bank's deal-making capabilities, just in part because it's done so many of them over the years. And as the bank continues to look to play a larger role on the world stage and to increase its deal-making capabilities, I expect the bank to look for opportunities to develop new skills, including transactions in both emerging and developed economies. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Erika. Now, Sergio Chichava will talk us about the role of Brazilian cooperation in Mozambique's agricultural sector. Two words before. For historical reasons, Brazil has always had an interesting link with Africa. But in recent years, this has been reflected both an increased flow of trade and investment, as well as by cooperation in novel ways. Brazilian investment in Africa is concentrated in petroleum, mining, and large infrastructure projects, including ports, airports, and highways, and mainly in Angola, Mozambique, and Kenya. Right now, there are 34 large Brazilian enterprises operating in Africa. Africa receives 55% of the disbursement made by Brazilian cooperation agencies. And Brazil has 35 embassies in Africa. So it's a very, very huge presence. And my question, I don't know about this issue, but my question is, what are the main differences between Brazilian cooperation and the European cooperation with Africa on this area? Sergio?
Thank you very much. As has been said, we'll talk about the role of Brazil in Mozambican agriculture sector. And first of all, I would like to apologize because of my bad English, but I think you will be able to understand what I have to share with you. And the question asked by the chair will be responded through my presentation and during the discussion. First of all, I would like to say that the case of Mozambique and Brazil is very interesting case for those who want to understand the Brazilian engagement in Africa. Because Brazil or Mozambique is the top beneficiary of Brazilian technical cooperation in Africa. And I think because of that, it's an interesting case. And it's also one of the main destination of Brazilian private capital. We have big companies like Vale, for example, the second largest mining company in Mozambique, which has concession in coal and phosphate. So a number of the Brazilian technical cooperation is concentrated in different areas like health, education, and agriculture. But agriculture is the main area of focus. That's why it's interesting to talk about the role of Brazil in Mozambican agriculture sector. Even if this cooperation between Brazil and Africa, and particularly with Mozambique, is very recent and was driven by the former president Brazilian Lula in the 2000s, there are some patterns or trends in Brazilian agricultural cooperation in Mozambique, similar patterns or some patterns that we can be found. And I will just mention three. One of them is the Brazilian trilateral cooperation in agriculture sector takes the form of a trilateral cooperation. And this kind of cooperation is made in Mozambique normally with the called traditional donors like Japan and the US. Obviously, this kind of partnership raises some questions. There are a lot of debates, some of them asking if Brazil is a truly development partner or is a closed donor like the traditional one, from which it seeks to differentiate itself. Another pattern that can be found when we look to the Brazilian technical cooperation in agriculture sector is the replication of Brazilian its own successful experiences. It means that the public policies in agriculture sector or which went well in Brazil are replicated in other in Mozambique. But also, this pattern is not specific to the agriculture sector. It can be found also in the other sector, like health. And also, it's not specific to the Mozambican case. Also can be found in other Brazilian South partners. What I can say that is unique in the case of Brazilian technical cooperation in Africa is the use of Mozambican case as a laboratory or a test case. It means that some programs of Brazil are being tested first in Mozambique before tested in other African countries. Among those programs, ProSavanna is undoubtedly the most ambitious, the most important Brazil agricultural program in Mozambique, and I can say in Africa. This program was initiated in 2011, and it is still in the research, planning, and technical stage. And it is a trilateral program between Japan, Mozambique, and Brazil, and aims to transform Nacala Corridor in the north of Mozambique, a region with 4 million hectares, into one of the most productive regions in the world. And it is inspired in a Brazilian and Japanese program, which was initiated in Brazil in the 70s and transformed Brazil in one of the most productive countries in the world. But although this program it is still in its early phase, it is facing strong criticism by local NGOs and by scholars who says that this project will not benefit local population, but will benefit local political and business elite. And it will also benefit the big capital. It is important to note that this kind of concern are not without reasons when we look to the recent developments in Mozambique. In this country, most of the time, the main beneficiary of foreign investment or foreign aid are the people linked to the local political elite and business elite. And for example, if we look what is happening in the area covered by ProSavanna program, we will see that actually there are at least four large agribusiness companies. Three of these companies are foreign companies, but one of them is a Mozambican company which is linked to the actual Mozambican president. So we can see that this kind of this kind of concerns obviously has some reasons. Yeah. Equally, ProSavanna is criticized because private and foreign investments are the main dynamic forces within the programs, as it can be seen in the official documents. So for the critics of this program, this contrasts with Brazilian discourse of solidarity diplomacy, where Brazilian cooperation is often presented as non-profit and unlinked to commercial interests. But it's a little bit too early, I think, to draw definitive conclusion about what will happen with Brazilian technical cooperation in Mozambican agriculture sector. But what I can say to conclude is, as we all know, Brazil has immense knowledge on agricultural development that it can be shared with African countries. I think the question should not be whether the programs are good or bad, but how to create the proper institutional framework, policies, and human capacity to ensure better use of transferred technology in the context of Mozambique's socioeconomic environment. And secondly, and to conclude, the debate around pro-savanna as well as Brazil's broader impact in the agriculture sector is linked to an intense argument on how to balance small and large scale agriculture and foreign and domestic investment. This is a debate that has not yet been settled in Mozambique. So, thank you.
Thank you, Sergio. And now, Professor Jenkins will talk us about South Africa and China, assessing the impact of asymmetrical engagement. Professor Jenkins, let me say only 1 minute, that Africa is facing an intense and rapid change. For a Latin American, it's not surprising to see that our region is lagging behind age and performance. But probably it's more surprising to take note that African GDP growth and export growth in Africa is higher than Latin America during the last 10 years. Africa shows a strong run of economic growth, a huge demographic transformation, the expansion of new African middle class, and explosive growth of new cities and megacities. And probably Professor Jenkins may help us to understand what is the mix between internal and external factors that explain this good performance.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to participate in this panel today. In this morning's sessions, there was quite a lot of mention of South-South cooperation and what that might involve, and also some questions about, well, what exactly we mean by the South. And we're reminded by Chris Walden that it's not just an economic concept, but it also has other wider interpretations and political ideological connotations. And in a sense, although I'm going to be looking at the economic aspects, I think these will raise some of the kind of contradictions between, if you like, the ideological and the material elements of South-South cooperation. I'm going to talk specifically about the relationship between two of the BRICS, South Africa and China. And I'm not sure that I will answer the chair's concerns, because South Africa is not typical of the rest of Africa. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's what I want to focus on today. The relationship between South Africa and China is a fairly recent one. In fact, it's only 16 years since South Africa recognized the People's Republic of China under the apartheid government in South Africa. It maintained diplomatic relations with Taiwan. But since then, and particularly since the early China joining the WTO in 2001, there's been a very rapid move closer together between South Africa and China, and particularly, of course, in terms of economic relations. Trade has grown very rapidly between the two. In the late 1990s, trade between China and bilateral trade between China and South Africa was about $1 billion. By the last couple of years, it's up to about $25 dollars. South Africa, China rather, became South Africa's most significant export market in 2009, and also it became South Africa's most largest supplier of imports. So economically, the two countries have become much closer together. And of course, politically as well, although not originally a member of the BRIC group of countries in 2010, South Africa was invited to join the BRICS, and the last summit of the BRIC countries was held in South Africa. So, and there are various, you know, the frequent travel state visits by the presidents of South Africa and China's political leaders, mutual visits on a fairly regular basis. So clearly there's been a very rapid expansion of engagement between the two countries. But nevertheless, what I want to suggest, or what the title I was given actually suggests, is that this is an asymmetric engagement. Of course, this is more, I mean, in one very obvious sense, it's asymmetric in that China is a much larger country in terms of population and in terms of GDP than South Africa. And so while China is very important for South Africa, South Africa is not so important for China. Although South Africa is China's biggest trading partner in Africa, nevertheless, in terms of its world position, it's not, you know, it's not on the same kind of scale, and that's an inevitable consequence of the differences in sizes of the two economies. But beyond that, I think there are two ways in which one can talk about an asymmetry, and I'm going to focus particularly on the trade relationship between South Africa and China, the way in which this is asymmetrical. Firstly, I hadn't realized that Davos style meant that you didn't have PowerPoints, so you have to imagine my graph showing the growth of trade between South Africa and China. But what it shows was that consistently South Africa has run a trade deficit with China. Its exports have not kept pace with imports from China, unlike some other sub-Saharan African economies that export natural resources. So there's that sense in which trade is unbalanced between the two. And as President Jacob Zuma pointed out at the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation meeting in Beijing in 2012, it's an unequal relationship based on South Africa exporting primary products or raw materials to China was not a sustainable relationship. So this asymmetry, which again Carlos Omnami pointed to in his comments this morning in relation to Latin America, whereby the main interest of China in the region is to do with the acquisition of raw materials, and the pattern of trade, as he put it, is very much the kind of center-periphery pattern of Latin America, and in this case South Africa, exporting primary commodities. About 80% of South Africa's exports to China are either primary products, totally unprocessed, or processed raw materials. So the bulk of exports are of those kind of traditional center-periphery kind of trade patterns, whereby, of course, China's exports to South Africa are very much manufactured, almost exclusively, not surprisingly, manufactured goods. And that's been a matter of concern. In South Africa recently, the Deputy Minister for the Trade and Industry in South Africa, visiting China, also commented on the need for more balanced and more sustainable trade relationship between the two countries. And what I want to, you know, to elaborate on that slightly, I want to share with you some of the results of some research that I did with a colleague, Lawrence Edwards, at the University of Cape Town, looking at the impact of the relationship between China and South Africa was having on the South African manufacturing sector. And if anybody's interested, I've got a briefing paper, a few copies of a briefing paper, which and if I can provide you with, which gives more detail on that research. And the two real aspects that we focused on, particularly in the way in which China was affecting the South African manufacturing sector, and I think the importance of looking at the manufacturing sector is related to comments again that I think the Osvaldo Rosales made this morning about the need for structural transformation or productive transformation in developing countries, and clearly a key role in that being played by the manufacturing sector. So what's been the impacts of manufacturing on manufacturing in South Africa? Well, there are two dimensions to it, or two aspects that we looked at particularly. One was the increased penetration of the domestic market, South African market, by Chinese imported goods, which although in aggregate it only accounted for about 6% of total consumption of manufactured products in South Africa, it's clearly much more significant in certain sectors. In footwear, clothing was over 40%, and a lot of electrical products, over 30% of the market, was accounted for by imports of South African of products from China. And although part of that came because things were being imported from China rather than from other countries, and the bulk of it was to do with a reduction in the market share of domestic production. And what made it particularly concerning, of course, was the fact that the impact that it had on industrial employment, because, of course, clearly in South Africa, one of the key issues has been the level of unemployment, 25% in official figures for unemployment people, 35% or more if a broader definition is used. So employment creation is critical in the South African economy. And again, those reference made to problems in this morning more widely to do with employment. And because a lot of the competition faced by South African manufacturers has tended to be in relatively labour-intensive sectors of industry, that has meant that employment has been quite significantly affected. And we estimated in our studies that between 2001 and 2010, there was a loss of about 75,000 jobs in the manufacturing sector in South Africa over that period. Another aspect that we thought was worth looking at, which doesn't get as much attention perhaps as it deserved, was the effect that competition from China was having on South African exports of manufactured goods to other markets, particularly exports to other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where South Africa has developed over the last, well, since the ending of apartheid particularly, significant export markets in the region. And these have tended to be relatively more sophisticated industrial exports as well. And again here, what we found that was South Africa was losing market share to China and the 10 most significant markets for South Africa in the region. And we estimated that if it hadn't been for competition from China, they would have had about 10% more exports to these markets in the absence of Chinese competition. So although that's not such a serious problem, given that the markets have grown quite rapidly anyway, so although in relative terms there'd been a loss of market share to China, in absolute terms South Africa still managed to increase its exports of manufactured goods. But that was the kind of context that I want to put, that, you know, on the one hand, we have a lot of talk, and ideologically there's a lot of talk about cooperation between southern countries, and that's very characteristic of discourse around cooperation between, or the relationship between, China and South Africa, and may well be true in certain areas. But in this key area of trade and the impacts on manufacturing, it seems to be not following that kind of the original idea of South-South cooperation, which was to break away from a particular kind of international division of labour. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rice. And now Paulo Esteves from PUC, Pontifical Universidad Católica de Rio, Brazil, will talk us about IBSA, India, Brazil, South Africa, and BRICS in comparative perspective. As a good Latin American, we negotiate the question, not the answer. So Paulo chose two briefly. First, in trade area, none of the BRICS countries are parties of the to the mega regional negotiations that are underway, such as the TPP and the TTIP. So in the future, what possible economic trade scenario can be foreseen over the next several years in terms of the interaction between WTO, these mega regional agreements, regional integration processes, and BRICS activities? And second, financial area. After hard negotiation 4 years ago, BRICS within G20 obtaining some small reforms in the quotas and the representation of developing countries in the International Monetary Board. Last week, United States Congress rejected all these minor reforms, coming back to the previous situation, and practically closing the door for several years for international financial reforms. In your opinion, what should be, if any, the response of free countries to this issue? Paulo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Prior remarks. The first one, I have to express my gratitude to CAF and LSE for inviting me. The second remark is, as Sergio, I have to say to you guys that I'm going to, not doing a good job with your native language. Sorry about that. And that is more pressing every time I'm in London, and I have to impose all the mistakes, grammar mistakes, pronunciation mistakes that I will do with you. And these times, every time it happens, I resent a little bit not to be colonized by the Spanish. If we speak Spanish in Brazil, it would make things really, really, really easier for us. At least at this point, we could have a simultaneous translation, and even talking in Spanish, much more people could understand us. Let's go to the point. My main job here is try to explore the difference between BRICS and IBSA. I have to tell you, my computer just died with my notes, but I have some here. I think they can help me. I will try to explore this difference among or around three different dimensions. The first one are related to goals and meanings of BRICS and IBSA. The second one is related to the impacts of BRICS and IBSA. And the third one, the third dimension, is related to the prospects for BRICS as, for BRICS and IBSA in the near future. Regarding goals and meanings of of BRICS and IBSA. There is a small story I would like to tell. It's related to the recent Snowden issue, and there is good to discuss this or to mention this here after President Obama has had after President Obama start to support more strongly the policies that the information community are taking in the United States. Brazil reacted to the NSA issue with two different courses of action, or two different lines of action. The first one was go to the General Assembly at the UN and try to pass a resolution, try to approve a resolution in which the right of a privacy could be considered a human right. The second action was directed towards BRICS, and it would be the construction or the building up of what they are calling now BRICS cable, or an alternative structure for the internet to face or to compete with the Western or American one, if you want. I do think that if we think that the first pattern of action go to a more universal or multilateral, at least, forum, and try to play with universal norms or with this game of particular interests and universal norms. If we think about this pattern of a behavior, you are going to have something really close to Ibsen. If you think about balancing, and if you think about building up alternative institutions to either compete or at least defy the current structures of power, you are going to think about BRICS. Taking freely Chris' presentation this morning, I would say both of them are coming from the 2.0 South, or the South 2.0, because you are actually playing with universal norms as a way to protect yourself or to be protected against the asymmetry of power within the international system. But at the same time, some of these countries in the global south, they start to compete more openly with the Western based or oriented international system, if you want. The difference between BRICS and IBSA, or the meanings of BRICS and IBSA, can also be understood if we notice that most of the descriptions about, or most of the analysis about IBSA refers to India, Brazil, and South Africa as middle powers, while most of the analysis about BRICS refers to Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa as rising powers. There is a huge difference, I think, between middle powers and rising powers. Middle powers are a kind of global players in the making. They aspire to be global players. They aspire to have more and more influence within the international system, but they don't have the means to do that. While rising powers, they are they imagine themselves, or they are described as actors that could, one way or another, interfere or intervene within the international system and change it. I do think this is the main difference between BRICS and IBSA. Not only power are in the DNA of both institutions, both IBSA and BRICS are political institutions, but BRICS is an institution created to reform to reform or even to balance the international system. In that sense, it's not only BRICS is not fed only by power, but by the idea of power transition within the international system. In terms of the impacts, and that's the second dimension I would like to tackle, in terms of the impacts of IBSA are really, really, really modest. IBSA has now several working groups, intergovernmental working groups. They are more or less consistent. IBSA has a fund to fight poverty and hunger, but the results of this fund are really, really, really modest. IBSA has a forum, a business forum, and an academic forum whose results are really detrimental. Compared to BRICS, we could say about BRICS that BRICS doesn't have any good or any significant result or impact either. But if we think about global governance, And if we recall that BRICS, they articulate themselves in the Security Council in order to block the Security Council regarding Syria, we are going to see that this is a really, really, really important impact, I think. If we think that BRICS are creating or that they are offering the world, especially Africa, alternative models of development than those exported by Europe and the United States. And if you think that these alternative models of development, they are being carried on throughout South-South cooperation, we are going to see that the impacts of the BRICS are really significant. And if we, in terms of the development cooperation field, I think this might be the most important effects of BRICS. There is a line I heard the other day which says that in the future, or now, if you want, all of us are BRICS. Why is that? Because the European Union and the OECD region are adopting the same pattern of behavior that the BRICS countries were adopting a while ago. So the Paris agenda of effective aid is being abandoned for the sake of fostering private investments in Africa and in the South. So in that sense, the model that was adopted by the BRICS, especially by China and perhaps by Brazil, as Sergio showed, these models are being adopted in the North. So I do think that this is a huge impact. Regarding the question of the rejection of the reforms in the IMF, right? In the IMF, this is an important issue in the agenda, but this is the way I'm going to the third dimension, related to the prospects. It is an important item in the BRICS agenda, but it is important in a very heterogeneous way. It is important for Brazil. It might be important for India. It might be important for South Africa, but it is not. It isn't important at all for China. China didn't push that much to the reform of the IMF, and some of the other BRICS countries, they resent that a lot. And that's exactly the way I'm trying to tackle. I will try to tackle the prospects for the BRICS. What are the BRICS? Are the BRICS a group of rising powers, or are the BRICS a group of middle powers around one rising power? If we think the way IBSA was described, let's say in terms of a draw, we can think about IBSA as a form of a butterfly. There is India, there is Brazil, and there is South Africa in the middle. If you think about the BRICS, we are going to think about a circle with a center. The relations between the BRICS, or Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa, in terms of trade, for instance, are not that great. The relations of each of these countries, as in the case of South Africa, with China, are really important for each one of them. So what we are seeing in the BRICS is a kind of dependence from the periphery of the BRICS to the center of the BRICS. It's not a matter of the integration of chain of values. It's a matter of, division of labor, which is highly asymmetrical among the BRICS countries. So in terms of the prospects of the BRICS for the BRICS, I would say the BRICS have a very important impact in the international order. The BRICS are, in a way, undermining some of the most important institutions in the international order, such as the Security Council, for instance, such as the regime for development assistance. And instead of building up new institutions or new norms, the BRICS are actually just weakening the existing one. And this might be good for the strongest, but it is not that good for the weakest. Among these weakest countries, I would say I would put some countries like South Africa, India, and Brazil. India, I'm not sure, but at least South Africa and Brazil could be grouped among the weakest. And the weakening of the international order is not a good thing for such for countries like those. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paulo. It's very interesting to take note that within the BRICS, probably we have center and periphery too. Huh? So the first round is complete. The floor is open for answer, comment.
I'll follow up on your presentation. What's the real situation of the bank, the BRICS bank? And I tell you, we as CAF, we were the Chinese government and the authorities in India and Brazil. The three of them asked us to make consultations about how the structure, governance, how CAF built up itself. And we have been in several meetings, but we didn't see much advance in recent times. Do you have any specific comments on the situation of that? And what is the feasibility or the complementarity, you know, in the case, for instance, of institutions like mine or the African Development Bank, whatever, it's very clear what you can do. Now, in the case of the BRIC, what type of institution will be a valid one? I don't know if you can answer that.
Would be a valid one?
Yeah. What is the value added, you know, among themselves? You know, maybe you can play a role. If you have a pool of resources, of course, you can play a role in globally, but in the cooperation between them, among themselves, how do you see that?
It's, I think this is still an open question. What I can say is that I cannot name them. It was a Chatham House rules, but I heard several comments from people from different countries that the model that the BRICS bank should follow is exactly CAF. I heard that several times from different sources.
I just want you to say.
It's a triple way investment bank. It's very efficient. Yeah. yeah. I'm not kidding. I heard exactly that that kind of comment. What I can say is it's old. It comes from it's dated in November. The information is from November. You probably have fresher information than that. But what I can say is that they were thinking about a initial installment of $10 billion dollars for each country. The entire fund would be $50 billion. It would be equal. So in terms of governance, there will be a isonomy between the countries. Regarding the role of the bank, is not even at the Brazilian position. I cannot say not even the Brazilian position. It's a position that I heard in Brazil for several players. They think that the bank could be open to lend money for anyone in a while, but now just for countries. Probably just the BRICS, but perhaps the African countries as well. So that was the latest news I have. The other thing I heard is that we are talking about a four-year timeline to the bank to be operative, but something will come up in July during the summit. Not the entire architecture, but something would come up in July. I know you know more than I, but nevertheless.
Going to French, you.
Just a quick follow-up to President Garcia's question. Parallel with the BRICS Bank, or before that, there was the G20 initiative of a global infrastructure bank. And then the BRICS Bank came. Could you sort of, using your model, look at pros and cons of a G20-sponsored bank, infrastructure bank versus World Bank, say, or the regional banks, vis-a-vis the BRICS Bank, because some of the Asian capital that I hear from, it doesn't seem the Asian powers are very keen to put money, really, into the BRICS Bank.
That's tough. I don't know. I mean, I didn't know the idea G20 infrastructure bank. I think the rationale is it's almost the same. One thing that is being said about the BRICS banks is exactly that it is a bank devoted to fund infrastructure. The main projects in the main areas would be related to infrastructure. So. I don't think I can use my model, because my model there is another component I didn't mention that it assumes that we are not talking about, when we talk about BRICS, we are not talking about South any longer. We are talking about at least the North of the South, but it is not. It's not the same. It's we cannot treat South as a homogeneous thing. So, in terms of the BRICS being part of the G20 and being part of a G20 bank would be a really good stand. I don't think it would be a problem. I don't know what happened in the negotiation. I'm looking at you, and I know that you know. You but nonetheless, I'm not sure if the BRICS were the ones who actually veto or who actually impose some kind of obstacles to the building up of the bank, of the G20 bank. My feeling is that they wouldn't be against it, against the idea, because when we talk about BRICS, we are talking about countries that wish or that want to be part of the oligarchy. That's simple as that, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Let me move away from the BRIC equation and talk about China, Africa. We commend China for the great things they are doing in Africa, in particular infrastructure. But some questions are being raised. One, for example, is why are some countries using oil to pay for their infrastructure? I see no problem in that. So you either pay in cash or some any other form. The problem would only come if really they are not getting fair value for the oil that they are using. So I think that's the question that we want to know. If they are paying market rates, there is no problem there. I think she should respond. She raised it. The second is that China buys raw materials from Africa. I say, welcome to the club. Who doesn't do that? The Europeans are buying our raw materials. So it's a question of really Africa putting its act together and, you know, selling value added, putting value addition to the raw material and selling it. So that one is not unique. Where I have problems with China is the issue of capacity building, where you are saying that there's a trade-off between speed of implementation and your willingness to train. I don't think that's negotiable. I think really, when you have projects, you should really put in a component for capacity building. Because who is in a hurry to deliver? Is it the Chinese side or is it the African side who wants this? And if the African side is, we want you to develop an infrastructure project, but in that context we want you to train our people, then don't, that shouldn't be an issue for you. That the question of, you know, the speedy and quick implementation should not be a trade-off for capacity building. So I think in most of your projects, you should really aim to put in capacity building. That's the only aspect that I find, you know, a bit controversial, and want to hear your comments on it. Thank you.
Okay, I think that this question is open for all panelists, because probably it's one of the main issues concerning the relationship between China, Africa, and China and Latin America. In Latin America, one of the main concerns is it's similar. It's the fear of repeating with China the center-periphery story that the region had with England in the 19th century and the United States in the 20s, and Europe in the case of Africa. So, if you want, what is the approximation of China to this issue? How do you see this question?
Okay, I'll start. I'm happy to start. I'll take the first issue of why pay in oil. I think that there are both China Development Bank and the Export-Import Bank of China have extended a number of commodity, including oil-backed loans, to borrowers around the world. And it's, as I mentioned in my presentation, it's not simply because China's a big importer of oil, but for the banks that make these loans, they view commodity-backed loans as a risk management tool because they say that if they, you know, they can track the flow, the oil exports from the country, and that gives them a really good idea of the country's cash flow. And I should mention that that China Development Bank and China Exim Bank aren't unique in doing this, that you have a lot of international banks that make oil-backed loans. And I think, you know, Angola is a great example of this, that if you sort of go back 10, you know, 12 years to the end of the Civil War there, that some of the first international banks that if you look at, you know, Societe Generale and institutions like that, Standard Chartered, they were making oil-backed loans to the government of Angola, and that was simply because due to all the uncertainty with the end of the war there, that they felt that these structured financings were the only type of business that they wanted to do in that market. So I think even though a lot of the discussion of the oil-backed loans from China, you know, sort of don't take into consideration this historical context, it's not a uniquely Chinese thing, although China also has the history of being a borrower and borrowing from Japan and paying back those loans with commodities in the 1970s. So I think that's the why pay. I think that's the why pay with oil, that it's not simply we're an oil importer and we could use the supplies, but for the individual institutions involved in the lending, it's a risk management tool.
You want to say something?
Okay, sure. I'd just like to add to that in terms of the oil question. I mean, presumably one of the issues too is transparency, isn't it? I mean, but then you don't really know what the terms are when it's done. But that's not irresolvable. It's just an issue that comes out of it. About the other point about, well, that you make about, well, it's the same as trade with Europe. I mean, that's partly the point that I was making, firstly, and that's, you know, there is the claim that South-South trade is somehow different, and what appears to be the case is that if you look at the structure of it, it is the same. Actually, it's not exactly the same. I mean, it may, in most of Sub-Saharan Africa, yes, you're probably right, in South Africa and in Latin American countries as well, actually, the proportion of exports to China that are primary products and processed raw materials are higher than the exports of those same countries to the rest of the world. Okay, so there is, for South Africa and for the Latin American countries, there is a bit of a difference in that it's, ironically, I guess, the trade with China is even more center-periphery type trade than trade with the rest of the world.
May I say?
Just on the capacity issue. Yes.
Yeah.
Enrique?
I can say something.
Just a brief comment about the former issue which was discussed about the excellent presentation of Paolo. In fact, I never understood, frankly speaking, the role of a bank within the BRICS mandate. I mean, so many banks already, the World Bank, Regional Bank. I would imagine BRICS to be a potential political power trying to intervene on major blockages of the world governance. You see, I would see BRICS mobilizing WTO blockade or negotiations on climate change or you know, even to go into the United Nations structure. This is the type of power which I would like to see. But my impression is that the fields are not ready yet for that kind of move. But the creation of a bank, you see, we have so many banks, there are capital markets. The same happens in Latin America with UNASUR Bank. Mm-hmm. And the big idea. I think this to me will not be the role of, on the contrary, I think it diminishes its major capacity of action, which is to intervene in the governance of the world and blocking things with the political powers of a majority of the world in population and economic power. So just to say that really the bank is not something which I would be very much expecting.
Can I come back?
Okay. Please.
Just quick answer to the gentleman. One thing is about the pay by the oil. I think there's a two level issue. One is that okay? Is that okay? All right. There's a two level of issue. One, whether it's logical, whether we have the reason to do that. The second is the whether you can do it in the right way. Okay. Now, for the first level, I would like to ask, if you do not pay for the oil, is there any other alternative? If you have another alternative, I don't think Chinese company really prefer you pay by oil. You can pay by cash or you can, you know, whatever. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm not making argument. Okay. I'm just answering your question. That's I think it's logical to pay in oil. I actually was very impressed by one of the leaders from Africa in an international investment forum. He said that we realize that right now, even we are rich in resources, but resources can't run out in the end, right? So we want to use our resources to change the development opportunity. I really appreciate that. It's exactly the same as China. At the very beginning, we said we want to use our market to change the technology. It's exactly the same. So I think the main thing is how to make it in right. It's more technically we are improving at, I think. That's one thing. The other thing is the capacity. I think I do believe most of the Chinese instruction company right now, they are doing intensively training for local people. I do have that number, but I didn't bring that with me, right? So I believe if you talk about specific project, they might like because they sign the contract according to their capacity. So they're going to do the first job by their own people because they also allow them to do that. And then along with that, they train your people so that they can use more and more local people to be with them. And in the end, when they finish the job, and then most of the team go back, and then they remain all the job for the local people. I think that's the thing that they're doing right now. I believe that's the right direction to go. And it's exactly the same thing for the Latin America so far. And they have very strict regulation that they cannot, the Chinese company cannot bring their own people there, so that's why a lot of the production cannot be happening. So that's exactly the truth. I'm not saying who is wrong, who is right, but that's just exactly the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the third thing is the IB. It's like what China is doing is like many years ago. I happen to be the international business professor. Okay. Now, the business principle inside this world is according to the supply chain management, right? So the global supply chain, how to distribute among the country, exactly depend on the location advantages of each country. China happened to be at the value chain that, you know, just, okay, let me do it this way. The Latin American country and African countries so far, okay, your advantages is the resources. You haven't developed enough your location advantages for the rest of the supply chain. That is why, including other foreign company, they doing exactly the same thing. They invest in these two areas, and then they get the resources, and then bring to other places, including China, to do other part of the value chain. I do understand your concerns. So I think the key thing right now, we're talking about the business. We're not talking about the government aid or something. Business is business. So the only thing that you can get the foreign company, including Chinese company, to do the part of value chain in your country, you're going to try to raise the factor inside that part. For example, and let me give you a simple example. I do not want to mention the country, okay? Inside Latin America, one Chinese company, they can do business relatively easy in one Latin country, and it's a little bit difficult in another Latin country. And I visit both of them. And the reason is very simple. In one country, they really lack of the qualified engineering. So they have to call constantly from home to support the business there. But in the other country, they all told me that, you know, they do have the qualified people there. And then the Chinese company, they even told me that if they can find someone can be the leader for the brand in that country, they're going to do that. So I do believe the government of our South country have a really heavy responsibility on our shoulder. We need to improve our own conditions so that we can really attract the foreign investment as what you wish. That's my answer.
And I have one additional quick point on the capacity building issue that builds on what Dr. Chen said. I think that when a lot of Chinese companies started investing overseas, they viewed overseas as a way to enhance their own capacity. So they were focused more on building up their own skills than those of the people in the country they were invested in. And just to give an example, when China National Petroleum Corporation went into Sudan in the 1990s, that generated a number of articles in Chinese oil industry publications about how what they did in Sudan should be used as a model for investment elsewhere, because they were able to bring a large number of workers to Sudan and give those workers international experience that the company really valued. And, you know, what was interesting to me is that their view that foreign investment should be a training ground for our workers generally isn't the view of host countries, who often say, okay, if you're going to come invest here, is there something you can do, you know, to help citizens of our country? And so I think that we've come, and even though I think some Chinese companies still look to make investments to build capacity, to gain know-how, there is a recognition that, you know, that they do need to build some capacity. And I think that the example that Dr. Chen gave was a good one of that. So I think, you know, in a relatively short period of time of 15 years or so, we've definitely seen an evolution, I think, in the approach of Chinese companies.
Thank you. Let me add some additional example about the capability construction. One of the main concerns in Latin America in relation with China connection is the lack of export diversification. I have attended the 7 events of China and Latin American Business Summit, and this is a classic issue in this discussion. But Chinese authorities are absolutely open to discuss this issue. But not only that, Wen Jiabao, former prime minister, when talking in our building, in ECLAC building, suggested a very, very integrated agenda of cooperation between China and Latin America, including infrastructure, joint venture in manufacturers, in services, upgrading agricultural technology, and so on. So, well, after 4 years of this proposal, Latin America has no response. In 2008, China issued the white paper about the relationship with Latin America, including economic, political, tourism, and several issues. After 6 years, Latin America has no collective response. So, my opinion, it's our responsibility to define what are the best way to make the linkage with China. And we need, of course, transparency, but also we need good policies and a strategic vision in order to define what is the pros, what are the gains in the relationship with China. We are close to time. Sorry. Finish. Some remarks? Someone of you, including remarks? You?
Can I say a few words?
One thing. One thing.
You too?
Okay.
Just to not leave President Iglesias' question without any comment, I think the rationale for the BRICS Bank, there is no single rationale for the BRICS Bank. I think each country has its own reason to support the idea of the bank. If you think about why China is supporting the idea, it's my impression that China is finding several ways to losing its own footprint in the international system, and a multilateral or minilateral bank would be a way to lose it, just to hide a kind of a hide beyond the bank. I think for Brazil, the bank is important as an answer for the problem of the World Bank and the IMF. I'm not saying that the bank can compete with the World Bank and the IMF, but it is the same rationale. If I don't have space in this system, and if this system seems to me to be unfair, I will try to build up another one in parallel to compete with the existing one. As far as I heard, I'm not sure about India, but as far as I heard about India, India has interest in funding its own projects. India seems to be the country which has a portfolio already done to present to the bank. South Africa's interest in the bank, it seems to me to be to use the bank as a way to make to get a strong position within Africa. So I do think you have several reasons to support the bank idea. I'm not convinced that the bank is a good idea per se, and my worst fear is exactly the fact that such a kind of institution and the behavior of the BRICS within the existing institutions could weaken the multilateral system in a way that could create some new problems for the BRICS countries themselves.
1 minute out now.
Just a quick comment. I think all these years, China gained a lot of attention, and this is very important for us. But China basically is a more inward-looking type of country. We have so many complicated things inside China, so we focus on our own reform for so many years. Until after these crises, and we start to have more relationship with the world. Actually, we are new to this world, and we want to understand more. But at the same time, for all kind of reasons, in this panel, we find that compared with other developing countries, we're sort of outstanding. And just after the crisis, just because the developing world get into their own trouble, so China appeared to be much more strong there. But we are not really that strong. In terms of the international business, the Chinese company doing business abroad, we're really new. We're not very capable to do everything as the world really expected. We're not really selfish, but our capability is not there. But I don't want to say the world have to wait China to be stronger so that we can be helpful. I think it's the most different between Chinese or the South countries multinational, young multinational company with the existing very strong developed countries multinational company. The gap of the capabilities is really strong. So we cannot really exactly follow their step. If I think the world realize, not only the government, not only our academics, if our world, Chinese and other South countries, we realize that we do, everyone of us, we have half capability. but we have the heart to cooperate with each other. And then the people want to be together, and then we'll create tremendous opportunity. You know, we cannot only sit and expect someone else who's strong enough to come in. I think that's very important. In this this year, in my forum inside China, I happened to invite some of the trading company inside there. And I just say that, you know, we want to do the alliances just because we are weak in terms of knowing this world. We're weak in knowing your country. And then the Chile company immediately responds saying that actually we did not think about it before. Now if you need us, we want to be your partner. I think that's exactly the right way to go. So we do want to, all of us, if we have any energy, any approach, and then we want the country getting together, not only business, the people getting together, so that we can have our heart together, we can have the trust built, and then our tremendous, beautiful future we can create it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with this very, very intelligent and modest word, we are closing this panel. Thank you.